This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend. I've walked your snow-capped mountains.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is October 15th, 2020, and this is episode 211.
I'm Scott DeLunnebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we recap the bombshells of pretty much the day that close out what has otherwise been a very eventful week in the campaign. Videos were leaked, candidates are off the ballot. Well, they're still on the ballot, but they're out of their party. There was a whole debate that we've pretty much forgotten about, and two platforms dropped this week. Lots happening. We're going to leave discussing those platforms to a standalone podcast because there's just so much going on, so we'll hopefully be able to get to that over the weekend. But we'll dig into lots of other BC poly election news. First, thanks to the 104 patrons who are contributing to the show every month. Our newest patrons, Blake and Kelsey, big shout out to you both. We had a great time live chatting in our Patreon Slack channel with all our patrons during the election debate. If you want to get involved in great conversations like that, support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. And as there's just about a week left in the election before it's all done, make sure you vote. If you've requested a mail-in ballot, get that off ASAP. Do you remember when Elections BC is telling people to get it back?
I think they wanted it mailed by the 17th.
Yeah. So this weekend, put it in the post box right away.
Yeah. So tomorrow, if you're listening to this on release day.
Otherwise, advance polls are open. You can vote also at any district electoral office until 4 p.m. on election day. And on the 24th, there'll be lots of options to vote. Look at your voter card. We'll have links in the show notes to Elections BC's where you can vote and how you can find who your candidates are. So vote. And as always, Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, which has been very helpful during the election, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's get into the main topic of the night. It seems like eugenics is the line for the BC Liberals. We'll get into the specific controversy with Laurie Thronis and how he got resigned, I think is what happened. He officially resigned of his own free will, but this feels like a very active resignation. But first, there was a controversy last weekend with a video of MLA Jane Thornthwaite making some rather unseemly remarks about fellow MLA Bowen Ma.
Yeah, so this is a video that got leaked on Saturday and came from a September 17th virtual event where they were doing a roast of outgoing MLA Ralph Sultan. And in it, Jane Thornthwaite, one of the North Shore MLAs for the Liberals, had some pretty sexist things to say about Bowen Ma and how she would be allegedly very flirty with Ralph Sultan.
Yeah, Bowen Ma is, I believe, the youngest MLA in the legislature at 35. Ralph Sultan is 87, the oldest MLA. They did have, by all accounts, a warm and congenial relationship in terms on a professional basis. But the comments Thornthwaite made, which it was a roast, so I assume were meant to be taken a bit lighthearted, a bit jokingly, but Thornthwaite called Ma a, quote, very pretty lady, and she knows that she's got it, and she knows how to get Ralph going. Which, this is an event where you had multiple Liberal MLAs, including the leader of the party, Andrew Wilkinson, there, all chuckling along or enjoying it, but it gets pointed out quite quickly once this leaks on Saturday that these are pretty toxic things to say about one of your colleagues and one of your coworkers, even if they're across the aisle, particularly a younger woman of color, the stereotypes that women are trying to, or younger women especially, are trying to use their feminine prowess to get ahead is gross and needs to be discarded from all politics.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
What made this controversy even worse was Andrew Wilkinson struggled to condemn it initially. He was asked for comment pretty quickly, I believe, and he did apologize and say it was the wrong thing to say. And by the debate, he had said very clearly that he disagreed with those comments and that Jane Thornthwaite disagreed with those comments and they apologized for them. There was a lot of confusion in the first days about on that Saturday about what the BC Liberal line was on this.
Yes. The video came out and Wilkinson and Thornthwaite did make statements about it. They weren't particularly definitive or apologetic in their first round. And then they had 2 days of more or less radio silence on it, where they weren't doing media appearances or anything, weren't taking questions. And it just let the thing linger for a couple of days. And by the time they'd finally done like a full apology, it had dragged on multiple days, had become the storyline of the week. And with just all around, like from a purely political strategy point of view, just horribly bundled.
And that just further fueled the questions about Andrew Wilkinson's leadership, which we're going to come back to the debate on that was on Tuesday evening and how they all performed in that. Because I want to jump ahead to the other candidate controversy and the other leaked video controversy, sort of leaked video. This was a all candidates debate in
Chilliwack. I don't think you can leak an all candidates debate.
You can post the video that would otherwise have only been seen by a few dozen people. I think that's what happened. And you clip it out. So not really a leak, but more of a, hey, look at what he actually said. If you imagine most all candidates eras in a non-pandemic, a lot of weird things will get said, but will get missed by Twitter because no one's recording it and putting it on the internet. Now all of the all candidates debates are on the internet.
And roasts, which are maybe the sorts of things that shouldn't have been recorded. Or, look, let's do that. One, like, who thinks a roast is a good idea, particularly in the middle of the writ? I know they have the thing scheduled since like August or something. I'm on Liberal mailing list. I got like notifications back in August about get your tickets or whatever. But like they should have canceled it or postponed it or whatever. And beyond that, is a bad idea to both do them and record. Like, has there ever been a roast that people think this is definitely a good idea and there's no possible way it could backfire?
Fair points. So, Lori Thronis, longtime embarrassment to the BC Liberal Party for numerous controversies. I think the last time we were talking about him was when he was continuing to run ads in the Christian Light magazine, which had a number of homophobic, transphobic articles, and Thronis said he would continue to run them there, even when the party had said they were not going to give any more money to this publication. Thronis, also the guy who, during the leadership race, pitched a bunch of wacky, wild ideas for the party, including making Mount Rushmore BC, which was one of the more lighthearted moments.
That was actually amazing. And like, it's clearly an absolutely nuts idea, but I don't know. I'd much rather have the Lori Thronis who proposes like outlandish public works projects than the Lori Thronis that wants to outlaw birth control because of eugenics or some such nonsense.
Yeah, so the question comes up about the NDP's platform policy announcement that they would provide free birth control through MSP. This follows the Access BC campaign and calls that people should be able to get birth control for free because it's a way to help make sure there's reproductive equality. And it's just generally a good, we provide vasectomies and on MSP, so why can't we provide condoms and the pill, among other things? Anyway, the question comes up, and you can disagree with the policy, but Thronis says, and the other thing that I feel about this is that it contains a whiff of the old eugenics thing where poor people shouldn't have babies. And so we can't force them to have contraception, but we'll give it to them for free. And maybe they'll have fewer babies. So there will be fewer poor people in the future. And to me, that it contains an odor that I don't like. So I don't really support what the NDP is doing there.
Yikes. There is a lot to unpack in that.
What I enjoy is that the first thing Andrew Wilkinson as leader tweets out in response to this clearly like ghastly comment, because giving people birth control freely is not the same as sterilizing them in any sense.
There's a distinctly different amount of consent going on in those two scenarios.
But Wilkinson tweets out that, let's be clear, I support government providing free contraception to anyone in BC who wants it, which, as far as I can tell, is him writing policy by Twitter, because I searched through the BC Liberal platform, and while they promote expanding IVF availability, there's nothing about contraception or the Access BC campaign in their platform. And so the BC Liberals just suddenly bought into this campaign as well, which is good.
This might be one of those things where, I'm not sure if you know this, but Wilkinson used to be a doctor. He hasn't mentioned it very often, but it's the sort of thing I could see a lot of doctors being supportive of, just naturally. And this also really does seem like a case of rush, of learning their lessons from this week's other big PR disaster, and actually rushing out a statement and responding quickly and not letting it marinate for several days.
Indeed, he rushed it out so quickly that the second half of that tweet read, what Lori Thronis said was wrong and against my position as leader of this party. I will be making this very clear to Lori when we next speak. In other words, Andrew Wilkinson took to Twitter to condemn one of his colleagues before even giving him a courtesy call. Imagine your boss tweeting out that they're mad at you before even like giving you a courtesy call.
Yeah, it's not the best way to handle things from a leadership position. In dealing with the caucus, that's for sure.
And so they clearly do have their conversation. And I think it was like 1:30 this afternoon, Andrew Wilkinson calls a press conference or a special press conference before his normal announcement of the day, and announces that Lori Thronis has resigned from the BC Liberal ticket. It's not exactly clear what he's resigned from other than the party. If he wins the vote, will he still take his seat? But he's not a BC Liberal anymore.
So the candidate list got locked in a week ago, 2 weeks now? I think 2nd of October. Anyway, the candidate list is locked. Ballots have gone out. They've been printed. There is no way to remove someone as a candidate at this point. So if you live in Lori Thronis' riding and vote Liberal, he is the one you will be voting for. But that does leave the awkward question of what happens if he wins, and he is in a very safe Liberal riding, so it is quite possible he will. And then that leaves Wilkinson in a slightly odd position. Is Thronis going to spend the next 4 years sitting as an independent? Does he resign from the ledge and a by-election gets triggered?
Refusing to take his seat would be a very, I believe it's Sinn Féin, the Irish separatists who refuse to pledge allegiance to the Queen, who sometimes wins seats in Northern Ireland. It'd have that kind of energy, but it would be less cool. So Chilliwack Kent is obviously a very strong BC Liberal seat. In 2017, Thronis got 53% of the vote to the NDP's 32 and the Greens 15. The NDP held part of that riding when it was Chilliwack Hope, but that was when they won it in a by-election when the BC Conservatives split the vote with the BC Liberals. And I think the Liberals were really unpopular at that point prior to the 2013 election. But aside from that blip, it's been a pretty safe center-right stronghold. It's Chilliwack.
Yeah, that does raise the other possibility beyond resignation or sin as an independent, is he could become a floor crosser and the first BC conservative in the legislature in a long time, which cannot be a comfortable prospect for the Liberals. We were chatting in a group DM before the recording, and we were actually before the announcement that he was resigned, and there was a lot of skepticism that they'd actually go this far, because a situation where Thronus joins the conservatives and peels off, I don't know, the 10 to 30% of the population that is socially conservative or has social conservative leanings, that could really hurt the Liberals going forward. Unlikely in this election, just because there's so few seats that the conservatives are even contesting, but you know, post election, it could be quite a problem if you have a MLA that is fairly well liked, but definitely has roots in his riding, switching over and trying to pull a lot of people with him.
I think I was more sympathetic to that theory when I wasn't thinking hard enough about how much talking about eugenics is bad. And not just like bad, but like it's really bad. And I don't think it's something most people are going to look fondly at. Like, people could be opposed to the government providing free contraception. I understand that. But once you start comparing it to like the Holocaust and to eugenics, you go down a real dark conspiratorial path. And you get into those like anti-abortion protesters who put the overly graphic symbols. And I know there's a contingent that doesn't like abortion, but I can't imagine the contingent that likes those graphic posters is that big, even within the anti-choice movement. So Thronus's like base of support is not big. And now that these comments are out there, I don't know how many others would even want to be associated with him, even if they might ideologically agree with him, which leaves him very isolated.
I don't know. It's a tough one, because I don't know. If you'd asked me pre-2016 on that, I might have a different answer, but I could see it being a large enough contingent, and views that used to be subtext now being text as an increasingly common phenomenon. I could see that pulling enough support away that it makes it very hard to put together an electorally viable coalition for the Liberals. And the Liberals are in a difficult position here in a way, because just under first past the post, it's hard to get the electoral math to actually work out in a way that you can have a center-right party that doesn't count on at least some socially conservative votes to get over the line into majority territory. But as we're clearly seeing from the discussion we're having here, that also has pretty significant electoral drawbacks. But having them go off and form their own party that has enough clout to be draw that portion away is quite problematic for them. It's a case where it might be better to have them in the tent than outside causing trouble and trying to pull a Stephen Harper and keep the lid on them and keep the Bozo eruptions tight, but not actually let them have much influence in policy, but instead just, you know, have them as part of the voting bloc and do the barest minimum to keep them in while doing everything you can to keep them quiet. And like, Laura Thronus has been a big, you know, pain in the ass for the Liberals whenever he does something that gets them a bunch of bad press. But there was zero chance that under a Wilkinson government, Laurie Thronus would be the ones making important decisions about social issues.
Weirdly, he had the role as critic for Children and Family Services, which if the Liberals won and went forward with their plan to bring through means-tested $10 a day daycare, seems like it would fall to his shoulders, but
I doubt
assuming he would. They might appoint a different cabinet minister, hopefully. Yeah,
I think the critic role is something you can maybe throw them to, like I said, try and keep the social conservatives in the tent and not get them too upset when you have a fairly liberal downtown Vancouver type of leader. But yeah, if they were to form government, I couldn't not have seen a situation where it would have made sense to put Lori Thrones in charge of like Children and Family. If they wanted to have a four-year government that wasn't constantly getting bad press.
I think the key thing here, though, is that this points that there was quick action today. It does highlight and flag what a failure of leadership there has been from Wilkinson and the senior part of the party. This is really brought out by a tweet thread late this afternoon by Nicole Paul, who's the membership chair of the BC Liberal Party, who went public with how she's long been a supporter of the BC Liberal Party and continues to stand by the values of free enterprise, but that the party under Wilkinson does not reflect the values she supports. And she talks about supporting LGBTQ issues and being frustrated by the lack of action by the leadership of the party on Thrones specifically. She talks how advocates have spent five months trying to get something done about him and being stonewalled until this like last minute where it's, you know, unquestionable that he crossed a line. Like, where was the party pushing back when Thrones was like openly rebelling, saying, I will run ads in something we have said as a party we will not run ads in?
Yeah, that goes to Wilkinson being a fairly weak leader. And part of that is he had a very weak mandate, you know, a last ballot just edged over the line win in the 2018 leadership race, which did not give him a particularly strong mandate from the party to, you know, chart a new direction or, you know, exert a lot of control and shape the party in the way he would want it to be shaped. And I also get the sense that he's one of those people who just doesn't do interpersonal conflict and negotiation, or not sure negotiation is the right word, but doesn't navigate tense social situations or things like this particularly well. So the two compounding on each other has left them in a really bad spot.
And it's quite the thing, because there's a part of me that really wants the Andrew Wilkinson Liberal Party to not necessarily succeed, but not be wiped out and fail so utterly. Because I do get the sense that Wilkinson's personal values actually aren't anywhere near those of Lori Thrones. Like, the initial policies he put in were to elevate women within the party. He has brought forward women's issues within the BC Liberal Party in a way that I think continues some of the things Chrissy Clark had brought on, but really keeps it going in his own way. I get the sense he does personally support LGBTQ issues. He brought his party alongside to support the creation of the Human Rights Commission. He brought his party alongside to support the passage of the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous People in BC. So I think he is there personally and able to bring his party, but just when it really push comes to shove and it comes to confronting the threats to those values, those, you know, socially progressive values within the party, like you say, he's been ineffectual and has been unwilling to stand up, which kind of undermines the whole purpose or those whole values.
Yeah. And I think there's also a situation where most leaders, I think, in general, would be a lot more comfortable being the leader that lost a tough election against a popular incumbent than the leader who saw the party they lead fracture under their leadership, and the electoral coalition that party represents break apart, which, combined with everything else, I think has also led to a lot of reluctance to really tackle this and risk the fracturing of, you know, the free enterprise coalition.
Everyone would rather be Stephen Harper than Kim Campbell.
Yes.
The other wild card that comes up on the Thronist question, at least with regard to the specific election in Chilliwack, Kent, is there is an independent candidate there, Jason Lum, who's running, and he is a former city councillor in Chilliwack who is quite popular. I think top three on the ballot, potentially top vote getter, very popular. He was a Fraser Valley Regional District Board Chair, and a lot of people are wondering if he could take the riding by peeling votes from now disaffected BC Liberals who have to find somewhere to vote, even though Thronus will still be on the ballot. There's going to be a lot of resources taken away from him. He can also potentially appeal to the NDP and Green voters. I was looking at his policies earlier today. They're a mix of socially progressive ones. Some mirror the NDP straight up, saying he wants to see $10 a day daycare fully funded and expanded money for healthcare. He's also just big on any local independent candidate, give my region a lot more money kind of policies, which are generally popular in a local region.
Yeah, that's the sort of politics that is, yeah, always popular. Give money to my constituents, which this is going to hint a bit at the platform policies we'll be going over in a subsequent episode, but it's something I'm surprised the Liberals haven't been doing more of when they're in behind and have promised to throw a bunch of money at various infrastructure stuff. They've been remarkably silent on actually just going to every riding and promising big infrastructure and big projects that are politically popular in that riding, which is, I think, part a sign of a larger problem in the Liberals beyond just the issues we were talking about before, is that it's a party that doesn't really know what it's about anymore. It knew what it was, but when the ground changed under it, it hasn't really adapted. And like a lot of parties that have been in power for a long time, that particular identity, once it's severed from actually being in power, often finds itself that it doesn't have as clear a sense of itself as it used to when it was newly in power. And nothing under Wilkinson has really made an effort at defining what it means to be a VC Liberal in 2020 beyond not being a New Democrat.
We talked about it a lot in the 2017 election, how the Christie Clark campaign of that election didn't seem to have any vision. It didn't really inspire people, and it was more just elect me because you don't want that other guy, and things are mostly fine-ish other than the housing affordability issue. And it's been pointed out by Justin McElroy and a bunch of people on Twitter and everywhere that the fact that election was not really decisive, right? We've talked about how it was a tie, almost a dead tie on the vote share. So there was no requirement that the BC Liberals reckon with what didn't work. The NDP and the Greens could point to how they both grew their vote and seat share, so it was wins for them. But the Liberals ultimately lost power out of that. But I think there was a feeling, arguably, that we just run that same campaign again and pick up two more seats and we're back in government, which is technically true, but still misreads the fact that attitudes have changed. And once you don't have power, you don't have incumbency. And so people can start imagining a different world. And that's where we're at.
Yeah, that's definitely from what I've heard being the mentality that's percolated through a lot of the senior levels of the Liberal Party. And the other, I think, flaw in their campaign has been a thing that so many parties have fallen victim to is not realizing that the public doesn't hate their opponent as much as they do. You saw this a lot in the last federal election campaign. You saw the liberals, the federal liberals, fall victim to it during the Stephen Harper years. It's a constant problem. And like the liberal platform is titled Restore Confidence, Rebuild BC, I think. Definitely the first part. But I was looking this up earlier today, going back to some polling back from the 4th of September, you know, a couple of weeks before the election started. 83% of BCers thought the government did a good job of handling COVID. The number for the economy was 57%. It was 53% for jobs and employment. There isn't a sense among the public that there is a confidence that is lacking that needs to be restored. And as a result, I think they've, in addition to not having much of a vision beyond just recapture a couple of seats, it does feel like a misread of where the province is at overall.
Well, now we've seen a couple more polls since last week, including, I believe, one since the debate, all still showing a lead of 15 to almost 20 points for the NDP, or in a couple polls back over 50%, which historically is unprecedented in this province. The only party that has gotten over 50% since, I think, Social Credit First won was the BC Liberals in 2001. And so I almost have to ask, is the election over already? Not even counting the number of ballots already put in mailboxes.
It's 2020. I don't want to say anything as a sure thing, but it's increasingly hard to come up with even a wild scenario in which the party's fortunes turn around at this point. We're only a little over a week away from the election. We had the debate this week. That was the Wilkinson's real chance to both make an impression to British Columbians overall and turn things around. And well, he wasn't terrible. He did nothing in the debate that would actually achieve that goal. I don't know. Unless a video comes out of Horgan, I don't even know doing what.
He could kick a dog and win the election.
Yeah, that might be. Shoot someone on Fifth Avenue. Maybe if there's a video of Horgan shooting someone on Fifth Avenue, he might lose the election. And even that might be a bit of a challenge with where things are right now. Like, it's going to be near impossible, I think, to turn this around, but barring some sort of absolutely unforeseen thing, which it's 2020. That could happen, but I certainly wouldn't want to be betting on that if I was any of the parties at this moment.
The event that was supposed to, or held the most potential to turn things, was the debate that happened Tuesday evening. There was another debate this morning over the radio that I totally forgot to listen in on, but I wasn't able
to get a chance to listen in.
Yeah, I didn't see any headlines suggesting anything exciting happened in there. But let's talk a little bit about Tuesday's debate. We'll come to the race question last, just because I think it was the only, it was the most relevant bit of the debate. But to get the rest out of the way, how do you think everyone did? You know, we've talked a little bit about how Wilkinson didn't seem to do enough to turn his fortunes around.
So there's a lot of talk about the expectation game. And in this case, everyone pretty much fit exactly where I expected them to. There was no surprises on there. I don't think anyone underperformed or overperformed what I was expecting. Horgan had a good, confident performance. Didn't land any knockout blows, but at the same time, didn't make any big screw-ups, with one notable exception that we'll get to. And overall, was fine. If you went into the debate thinking, I'm not sure, do I want to know, is it time to change direction for the province? Nothing that happened to or from Horgan would give you any indication that things necessarily needed to change, I don't think. Wilkinson, yeah. On the other hand, he wasn't that great in the one debate we saw him with against Horgan before back during the proportional representation referendum. He's not a particularly great debater. He has a very kind of monotone delivery in a lot of ways. Wasn't able to correct that going in this debate. He had the occasional good point, but nothing that would really decisively hammer the NDP enough to, I think, cause a lot of votes to swap over to him. And in that sense, I think he had the weakest performance overall, just in terms of the stagecraft and artistry of being on a debate stage, but also in terms of having to accomplish what he needed to accomplish. He didn't do that. It would have been a fine debate if he was in first place and just needed to hold that position. But as the opposition leader coming behind in the polls, he didn't exceed the level that he needed to turn it around. And so on your first note, decent debater, speaks clearly, has had a bunch of decent points, couple retorts that I think were pretty good. There was one about where Horgan was saying something along the lines of, we need to, accomplish whatever when you return BC NDP government. And she had a reply about, we could be doing this now if you didn't call the election. That was a good line. But overall, I think did a good enough job where she, I think, showed that at least her personally should be back in the legislature. I hope she holds on to her seat. I think a lot of people came away with that same impression. But if you were debating between the two leading parties and aren't sure if the Greens are worth throwing your vote to, I'm not sure she delivered anything that would convince people of that either.
I think I agree with most of that. I think I saw a number of people claiming the less partisan people, more punditry type, claiming First and Out was the winner of the debate. And I think that largely comes down to as well the question on race, where she was the only one who didn't fail it miserably.
At least understood the question.
Jesus. Horgan, like you say, he did what he needed to do. I think he did better debates in 2017, but maybe I'm misremembering because there were some awkward moments in there where he was like overly aggressive and then...
Yeah, his first debate did go particularly well. And when the narratives coming out of that debate was angry John, and there was a moment between him and Clark that a lot of people interpreted as sexist. He turned it around for the follow-up.
He was more alive in them. Like, he wasn't flaccid in this by any stretch, but he was just keeping it a kind of constant level of energy. Not as constant as Wilkinson, who, like you said, came off monotonous. Wilkinson, I think, underperformed for where I expected of him. He met every stereotype you have of Wilkinson, that people would have of Wilkinson being the doctor and the lawyer that he reminded us several times, is that he would be too intellectual. And I think it comes across that he struggles with interpersonal connections and with that sort of empathy that people often look for in a leader. Arsenal was the mirror of that, not to say that she was an intellectual lightweight in any way. She knew her policies that she was talking to, but she clearly bled empathy and compassion in every answer she gave. So Horgan and Arsenal definitely did what they needed to do. Wilkinson was in the corner of that debate stage, struggling through it. And it was almost a little bit hard for me to watch him at times.
I think the empathy points a bit on cue. So I've been making jokes throughout this recording about Wilkinson being a doctor, and did anyone know that? Because he talked about it fairly constantly. And I can see why his team told him, oh yeah, you should play up that you're a doctor. We're in a pandemic. It's an obvious connection there. There are reasons why having a medical background would be very helpful for a leader in these times. The problem is, I don't think the details of why that's important, and most importantly, the fact that that the why behind that is about caring and empathy and healing sort of stuff. And none of that came through from Wilkinson.
It's also unclear to me how long he was a doctor. I was looking at his LinkedIn just after the debate to figure out what his bio was. And there's like a 2 or 3 year gap where I think he's probably a practicing GP. And maybe he had a couple of extra years in there as a resident. But he went fairly quick straight from med school to several years later, he was at law school in Dalhousie.
We know it was long enough for him to deliver at least one baby.
Yes.
Which was, I think, the surprise revelation of the night, that there is apparently a baby named after Andrew Wilkinson somewhere out in the province that he delivered.
Yes. So let's get into that whole disaster. Shachi Curl, who comes from Angus Reid, I believe, was the moderator of the debate. And she asked a question about how on race and how each of them has personally reckoned with their own privilege and unconscious bias as a white political leader. And even before they started to answer, I was like, all right, we're going to do the race question with the three white people on stage. And it went worse than I expected. Because I feel like each of these leaders has for sure been around enough social justice-y conversations that, especially Horgan, that they should be able to flub their way through something that's not embarrassing. Wilkinson goes first, and he starts talking about how he was a doctor, and he worked in Indigenous communities where he, quote, got to know their way of life. And then he talked about that fact that he delivered a boy in Lillooet, who's now a man, probably, and took his name, and he says, that's the kind of experience that humanizes it for you and makes you realize we are all equal.
It's not a... Yeah, it was a bad answer. It may have passed muster a couple decades ago, and it may be a province that's slightly less progressive than BC. Definitely didn't really fit with the times and felt really awkward and forced.
Yeah, and it carries a bit of that white savior complex. Like, I went there, I did my mission work in Africa, I know what they're like. And it's a little bit patronizing. Like you say, it wasn't directly racist. Like, he didn't insult people and he didn't put anyone else down. And he, you know, emphasizes that people are all equal, but it doesn't lift anyone up, really.
It would have been a passable answer for a reform candidate in the 90s, maybe. But not a liberal leader in 2020.
But thankfully for Andrew Wilkinson, John Horgan got to go next, and he talked about how he, quote, played lacrosse with Indigenous friends, with South Asian friends. For me, I did not see color. I felt that everyone around me was the same.
And this is the one line that I think made it into the following cover and kind of defined the debate and the follow-up from it.
Honestly, it's like the only thing I remember from the debate. That and
you sold the land. There were very few changes besides the first and out one I mentioned earlier that, yeah, are memorable enough that 2 days later, I can easily pull it up.
And again, Horgan's answer could work a number of years ago, but it still has that some of my best friends are black, or...
It has big, like, suburban dad energy to it. And in that
sense... Which is his brand.
Yeah, in that sense, it almost works. And this... And I know the discussion drew a lot of attention afterwards. I'm not necessarily convinced it is the sort of thing that resonates outside of kind of people like us who spend a lot of time thinking about these issues and talking about it. I'm not sure it would have... He addressed it very quickly, like literally as soon as getting off the stage, he apologized, walked it back. But I'm not sure it's would have been the sort of thing that if they hadn't been that quick on the draw on getting the damage control on it, it would have really caused as much problems as I think people like us who focus a lot on politics and think about it obsessively necessarily would have assumed.
We have a prime minister who has done blackface multiple times. So I think a lot of people are willing to let a lot pass while still voting for the thing. I will note, just for a second to come back to it, Horgan's apology right after, in his scrum after, he said, quote, "I don't have a clue as a white person the challenges that people of color face every day." Wilkinson, I think, also tried to clarify his comments a little bit more, though he didn't directly apologize or walk them back fully, as far as I recall. Like you said, I think they can work if you play them around a bit differently. But in both cases, they're just tone deaf. And like, definitely on the NDP's team, there are a lot of people of color. There are a lot of people advancing some very strong positions on racial justice issues. I know a lot of people are critical of the NDP, for example, the actions in Wet'suwet'en and not defunding the police immediately, but they operate within certain structures and are at least moving forward with the UNDRIP bill and the police reforms committee.
I'm a little skeptical it would have had a massive impact with the broader electorate. It really would have cost Horgan a lot of problems and votes, especially now that the Throne of Stuff has completely pushed that this story to the background. Where I do think there was a lot of potential damage that could come out of this is what you're alluding to, which is the internal party piece on there. And in that respect, I think that was where it was really good of him to move quickly and put out the fire from a political strategy point of view.
And I want to finish, and I do want to mention First Now's comments as well. She talked about her reactions as a parent and how, quote, "I can't imagine being a mother and imagining that my child, my son, might die because of the color of his skin." And she talked about that she would have had to explain to her child that you can't trust the police because of systemic racism. And so she had a clearer understanding of both the question and how to address it. The follow-up question from Curl, though, was on, "Yeah, but isn't your party super white?" It was a slightly more eloquent version of that, but it was pointing out that of the three slates, the green slate has the least or the fewest people of color. And so there's still that long-standing challenge for the Greens of diversifying, which is a long, hard road.
Yeah, I know something the NDP likes to point out a lot about the Green Party is that they do tend to be pretty white. It is also the case that First Now had been the leader for, what, a week? And then had 2 weeks after that to put together a slate of candidate slates. I don't know where Adam Olson left things in his time as interim leader. Typically, interim leaders aren't big recruiters of candidates. So yeah, I'm willing to cut the Greens some slack on this on account of it being a snap election literally a week into the new leader's time in the role.
To some extent, like, the Greens weren't able to put together a full slate. They were running 74 candidates in 87 constituencies. Shannon Waters did pull together some stats on diversity for BC Today. The NDP are running 46 of 87 candidates as women. 21 are people of color, including 12 women of color. There's 5 Indigenous candidates, 6 queer candidates, 3 have disabilities, and 4 are under 25. The Liberals, by contrast, have just under a third of their candidates, 27 are women, 3 are Indigenous, 3 have disabilities, 2 are under 30, and there's 1 who's queer, but they're not public, it sounds. And the Greens, 30 of 74 are women, 11 people of color on that ballot. They have 2 Indigenous candidates, 4 queer candidates, and 4 under 30 years old.
And so the youngest candidate, who I believe is still in high school in Saanich.
She turned 18 in this week, so she is eligible to be elected next week. And I hope she wins, but I don't think she will. I just like the idea of a 18-year-old running. That's Kate O'Connor, I believe. It's tough to recruit candidates, but First Now has been involved in the Greens for a while. And efforts to recruit candidates need to be going for a while. Like, the Greens had a pretty clear warning that an election was a possibility. Yeah, it's tough being strong right into it. But
the hint of that did come in the final days of the leadership race. And depending on who won, there were very different visions of what the BC Green Party could be. And the slate of candidates you build from that is going to be different. So I can definitely understand why an interim leader wouldn't necessarily feel it's proper to put together a slate of candidates with no idea of what direction the party is even going to decide to go.
Oh, but I'm saying first now, even as a candidate for leader, could have been starting to think about who her team would be across the province during her campaign, because she was a pretty clear front runner for most of it.
Yeah, perhaps. On the other hand, if there are stories come out about, okay, you're recruiting your candidates for that, there's the possibility of the backlash from measuring the drapes before for the office before getting elected to it. It's a tough thing all around. Like, I honestly don't know if there's a right answer to this, but there's enough other factors there that I think cutting them a little slack is due.
I think that kind of wraps up all my thoughts are on the debate and most of the political news from the last week of the election. Did you have anything else before we turn it over to talk about a little bit of the Facebook ad spending?
The only thing I'm really going to say is that I think this is just by far the most consequential week of the campaign, and we'll see what the final week brings. But yeah, the first 2 weeks weren't all that exciting. Not much happened. This was the week where the dominant narratives got set, which are not good for the Liberals, considering the two stories we spent most of the episode talking about. And this was also the week of the debates where any chance to change the channel on that didn't end up happening. I guess very briefly. So the big benefactor of Horgan's gaffe at the debates was, I think, Andrew Wilkinson, just because it took the took focus off the Jane Thornthwaite controversy and had a, well, everyone kind of thoughts on these issues feel to it, which has now been completely overridden by the Lori Thronis problems. So yeah, this I think is the week where we will look back and say this is when the Liberals definitively lost the election.
Yeah, it went from a fairly certain thing to a certain thing.
Yeah, it was an uphill battle before, but the grade is now 50% steeper.
The one advantage the Liberals might have is that a number of votes are already locked in. I was just checking, and Elections BC says as of midnight last night, October 14th, they'd received 148,000 ballots already by mail, which is about 21% of the 710,000 that have been issued so far. So lots of people are requesting mail-in ballots. Hopefully they all mail them in or otherwise get to vote, but it's interesting to see quite a few ballots going in. You can actually see how many votes are being issued by constituency on BC Elections BC's website, and we'll put that link in the show notes. The other really interesting numbers that I found today is the Liberals have essentially doubled their Facebook ad spend in the last week. I had it on the blog on politicos.ca for last week, how much each party had spent, but the Liberals are now up to $224,000 on Facebook ads in the last week alone. This is over double what the NDP is spending, about $85,000, and the Greens are up to $4,000 in total. Just a massive discrepancy. I can't imagine that the NDP aren't spending the limit on this election, given that they had the largest war chest, and why not spend it all? Maybe the Liberals are just putting more into Facebook. I tried looking a little bit at what the kinds of ads each were running. They're all what you'd expect. The Liberals are promoting elements of their platforms, attacking the NDP. The NDP are doing the same. The Greens are doing just a little bit less, but also advertising a few stories where they're talked about because they're still doing that, whereas the others are really big on promoting their own websites.
Yeah. The ads I've actually gotten the most of are, for some reason, George Affleck ads. I don't live in his riding. I don't work in his riding. I don't think since the pandemic has started, spent more than maybe an hour or two in his riding. But for some reason, his ads are the ones I'm getting bombarded with the most.
Well, we'll see how ads go in the final stretch. The other thing to look forward to in the next couple of days is, like I said, we'll be reading through the platforms and trying to get out an extra podcast to go through the highlights of the BC Liberal and the BC Green promises.
Well, let's do a couple quick takes just to wrap things up. So first up is a follow-up to what we're talking about a lot in August before the federal parliament got prorogued, and that is the Wii charity scandal. So this was the big scandal that Trudeau didn't officially prorogue parliament to get away from, but everyone knows he did because there was literally no other reason why it made sense to prorogue the House for several weeks. It's back in the news, as last week the NDP and Liberals, oddly enough, teamed up to block Conservative efforts to get further study into the Wii affair. And this week, the Conservatives hit back or responded by proposing to create yet another Commons committee, this time a special anti-corruption committee to investigate this.
Oh, this gets... These parties are like losing the plot through like procedural wranglings. Like the NDP is apparently also proposing a committee, but it would be a bit more broad and would look at any other possible or bad smelling funding awards during COVID, because the anti-corruption committee also sounds very McCarthy-esque. But in either case, Peter Julian was trying to defend the NDP's decision to vote with the Liberals to essentially refuse, as far as I understand it, refuse to continue seeking specific documents relating to the Wii charity in one of these committees, because they say, as Julian says, that they believe one special committee that is focused on these allegations is the best way to proceed. Otherwise, you've just got this duplication and possibly gaping holes between the different committees who are studying it at different times. So they're endorsing the Conservatives' approach, and it sounds like they're starting to talk between the two parties about what the exact scope is and create some kind of omnibus corruption committee to tackle the Liberals. But really, it doesn't make any sense that you would want to put all your eggs in that one basket when there's no harm in these committees all pursuing the same question.
Yeah,
from slightly different angles.
In addition to that, this also seemed to be a bit of a political misstep for the NDP, because well, you can dig into the procedural wranglings of this and stuff. But the dominant perception that I think came out of that was that the NDP was carrying the Liberals' water on this one, which isn't necessarily a good look for the NDP. And if you have to go back and explain that, no, actually, we do want to create another committee on this one, which is why we voted not to continue things with this other committee. It's a complicated story. It doesn't communicate the key points nearly as clearly.
Yeah, unless the NDP got something out of this.
You better hope it'd be.
But it's unclear what they would have gotten.
This was the thing that hurt the Liberals a lot. Like, they felt the need to prorogue Parliament to stop the bleeding on the issue. There's blood in the water, and you got to wonder why the political sharks in the NDP aren't circling more on this one. And if they decided not to and pull back for a reason, they'd better got a massive concession out of it to make it worthwhile.
I mean, hopefully this one committee to rule them all comes forward and keeps this story going. Otherwise, this might be the slow dripping end of the Wii charity saga. It may also be that Canadians aren't caring as much as they were 2 months ago, and the Liberals' ploy actually worked.
That's true to an extent. Like, I think if this story had happened back in August, it definitely would have drawn a lot more attention. We actually bumped this from, or we actually didn't even put in our notes last week because we had so much else to talk about. It didn't rise to that level with everything else going on. But it's one of those things where there's clearly something to it and something that's politically damaging. And if more facts come out, which it's quite likely there will be something at some point if these committees do manage to keep digging, that could reinvigorate the story.
Well, keep our eye out for that. In other federal political news, Ottawa is going to be investing $20 million to preserve 186 jobs and create 52 job co-placements.
What's interesting about this story isn't the jobs they're creating. It's
what those it's the nuclear.
Yeah, it's what the jobs will be doing. So they're putting this money into an Ontario company, Oakville, Ontario's Terrestrial Energy, which is a company that works on SMRs, small modular reactors, which are the next generation nuclear technology that, rather than the giant plants everyone thinks of when they think nuclear power, much kind of smaller, more modular reactors that haven't, hence the name, that have a potential to make nuclear both a lot more feasible, cost-effective, and easier to use in a much wider variety of applications.
This does seem to hold a lot of promise for the phase out of coal in some provinces, for getting smaller and northern communities off diesel generators, which are still quite common, and doing lots of little shifts like that I think are very good to see. The challenge is always the question of, is nuclear the most efficient outlay of money? I'm a little more optimistic maybe about small modular reactors than some of the larger scale things that have been built in the past, even though I still, as an engineer, have that, oh, it's cool and I like it, sympathy. There was a paper in Nature Energy just this past week that had some academics look at the emission reductions between countries who pursued pure nuclear, or the emission reductions between countries who pursued renewable electricity versus nuclear. And across 123 countries between 1990 and 2014, they found that larger scale nuclear attachments did not tend to actually lower carbon emissions. Similar investments in renewables would. In fact, they found that countries that tried to do both often saw these large-scale nuclear reactors push out and crowd out renewable alternatives. This was a little bit less of a case in wealthier countries. Your European countries would see some reductions by going to nuclear, but poorer countries, it seemed like all of their money had to go one way or the other. And because of the concrete cost, for example, to build a nuclear power plant, and just the scale, they didn't get enough electricity out of it to offset. But it just raises that question for me. I'm sure there's a number of issues with the study itself, because it's also just a correlational study.
It doesn't really touch on kind of the more recent developments in the technology space. And yeah, these SMRs have a lot of potential. Some of the models that are being worked on, for example, don't require these ginormous pressure vessels that are both very difficult and expensive to manufacture, and then require a lot of concrete in addition to that for shielding and encasement. And this is potentially a much cheaper option that can cover baseload power and a few other things, and wouldn't necessarily take 6 years just pouring concrete to get a plant up and before you can actually start building the reactors themselves in there. So it's a technology I'm quite optimistic about. I'm glad to see the government spending money on it. But yeah, with respect to renewables, I definitely think it's more of a case of complementing it, where I could see these filling like a baseload situation to complement the renewable intermittency rather than a direct replacement. And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.